I'm ABC's Aaron Katursky, and this is Bringing America Back, What You Need to Know. Already in the grip of a deadly pandemic, the nation has been convulsed by days of protest over the death of George Floyd. In many cities, the demonstrations have devolved into vandalism, looting, fires, and clashes with police. A country of shut-ins is now outdoors, together again. A country reeling from public health and economic crises exploded after just the latest incident exposing a deep-rooted inequality in all aspects of American life, from law enforcement to health care. Mass protests against police have brought thousands into the streets, and they're raising concerns about new coronavirus outbreaks.
How many super spreaders were in that crowd? Well, they were mostly young people. How many young people went home and kissed their mother hello, or shook hands with their father, or hugged their father, or their grandfather, or their grandmother, or their brother, or their sister, and spread a virus?
That was New York Governor Andrew Cuomo earlier today. Dr. John Brownstein is an epidemiologist at Boston Children's Hospital and an ABC News contributor. From an epidemiologist's perspective, how do you view these crowds of demonstrators?
Yeah, it's an unfortunate situation in that we have two competing public health crises happening at the exact same time. And so it creates a challenge in dealing with both of them simultaneously when the activities of one are not aligned with the activities that are required for the other. And, you know, as we've said all along, mass gatherings create a great opportunity for virus transmission. On the other hand, these protests are incredibly necessary. And so the best thing we can do is to offer guidelines and practices for safe participation in these events. Clearly, it's not bringing risk down to zero, and we expect to see increase in cases as a result. But again, you know, these are necessary activities in this moment in America.
And so what is one to do if you are moved to go out into the street?
You know, I think it's everyone's right to be able to go and do this. The only thing we encourage is, of course, mask wearing, hand sanitization, you know, practicing social distancing where you can, you know, trying to do so and participating as safely as possible. You know, that's the best we can do, and hope that these events don't sort of have secondary consequences, which of course would be, you know, emergence of new waves of transmission. The other concern clearly is that in situations where conflict arises and the use of pepper spray comes into play, you know, these can induce coughs, which again further, you know, might worsen, you know, virus transmission.
People have been shut in, they want to go express themselves, and yet this precise kind of gathering does pose a risk of transmitting the virus.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, we're calculating risks. And, you know, in times before, you know, it wasn't a necessity to go out and demonstrate solidarity in an important, you know, position of the need for change. Right at this moment, that is more critical. And so clearly, you know, there's a balancing of risks. But again, you know, police brutality is another public health crisis that needs to be addressed just as much as the pandemic does.
How concerned are you that there could be a wave of infection that results from all of the protests that we've been seeing?
Clearly, the protests have been taking place in places that are still at the very early stages of reopening. You know, here in Boston, that's true. Same is true in New York City, other places that have experienced the worst of the virus. So, you know, and these are not places where transmission has come down to zero. There's still active transmission happening in the community. So we expect to see, you know, cases rise as a result of this.
Dr. John Brownstein with us from Boston. Amid all of this, businesses are reopening from their coronavirus closures. As of today, you can get a haircut again in Connecticut. Chris Rose is the owner of Professional Barbershop in downtown Hartford, where he's been cutting hair for the last 30-odd years. How is it to be open again, Chris?
It's great to be open again. After 2.5 months of being closed with zero income, it feels good again. It feels like the country's getting back to normal now. In a slow pace, but seems like things are getting back to normal.
Did you have a crowd of customers waiting for you to open this morning?
A huge crowd. People calling like crazy, making the appointments for today all week long. And it's just, yeah, it's today is, Mondays are usually our slow day because, you know, barbershops usually close on Mondays. And it feels like a Friday over here at the barbershop today.
That's got to be a good feeling for you after, as you say, a couple of months of being closed.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic feeling. You know, it was tough to just sit at home for 2.5 months. And just, I don't know. You know what? It makes me definitely feel, you know, I definitely don't want to retire anytime soon, you know? Nice to go back to work.
How are you taking precautions or anything you're doing differently to make sure that everybody's staying healthy and safe?
Well, we're following all the rules with the state of Connecticut. Everybody's got masks on. We have no waiting room. We're disinfecting everything before and after customers. So we are definitely taking precautions on nobody getting sick or spreading anything. We're taking people's temperatures where they come in. We're not even letting people hang up coats or jackets or anything. It's different. It's definitely different now, the barbershop feeling, but it's coming along, you know?
I mean, I know I'm desperate for a haircut. How rough a shape are these people's heads in? I feel like we're a nation of mullets.
You know what? It seems like everybody is walking in here. It's like going back to the 70s. Everybody's got a big head full of hair. They all look like Will Ferrell and Anchorman.
Chris Rosa from Professional Barbershop in Connecticut. It probably won't take much convincing to get people back to a barbershop. But what about the subway or a commuter train or a bus? As New York City prepares to begin phase one of its reopening next week, ABC's Amy Robach spoke to the interim president of the MTA, Sarah Feinberg, about safety and the subway.
Governor Cuomo has said reopening doesn't mean going back to how things were in the past. So how is the MTA preparing for this phase one of reopening?
That's right. Well, it's good to be with you. So the first thing to know is we've been planning for this reopening since the beginning. So we've been planning for this now for many, many weeks. The first thing that we've been doing is cleaning and disinfecting the system. So we now clean and disinfect the stations twice a day, and we clean and disinfect all of the fleet of rail cars multiple times a day. So we're doing everything we can to make sure that the cars and the stations and the buses that people will be getting on are as clean and safe as possible. We're also taking a lot of other steps, making sure that we've got hand sanitizer on hand in stations. You know, masks will absolutely be required, but we'll also have a few masks on hand for those who, you know, for that first day or two, forget their mask at home. So we're trying to do everything we can to both make sure that the system is as safe and clean as possible and also communicate with our riders about what they can do to keep themselves safe.
I'm curious what you think about the CDC recommendations that workers should avoid mass transit like the MTA. What do you think about that?
Well, look, it just doesn't work in New York City. So if people in New York City decide not to use mass transit and everyone gets in a car instead, no one's getting anywhere. No one is getting to work that day at all. You will run out of gas on one of the bridges, and you will be stuck in bumper-to-bumper traffic on the FDR or some other road, but no one's getting to work that day. So, you know, look, I think the CDC is doing the best they can under very tough circumstances. I absolutely disagree with them on this one. That might work in some places. It might work in the suburbs. It might work in rural America. It's not going to work in New York City.
Yeah, and even if you did get to where you were going, good luck parking. All right, Sarah Feinberg, thank you very much for joining us today and for all of your efforts during these times. We appreciate it.
Great to be with you.
Concerns growing that widespread protests may cause coronavirus cases and death tolls to rise. With me now is ABC Chief Medical Correspondent Dr. Jen Ashton. There are so many concerns today, but a lot of people are starting to go back to work. Yeah. Cities are reopening, and so workplaces are trying to figure out if testing can be used as a way to get employees back to work.
Well, we're certainly looking at that, and that's the hope. But we even heard the Atlanta mayor say if you were protesting this weekend, you should be probably tested for coronavirus this week because you're close together, you're yelling. In terms of testing, here's what we know right now for a deep dive. The FDA authorized the first home option saliva test back on May 7th. That may be hugely important as people try to go back to work. It was developed by researchers at Rutgers University. There is one FDA authorized at home nasal swab. But the thinking is really that saliva testing, because it's so much less uncomfortable than the nasal swab, may be better as it gets brought into the mainstream.
And we don't have long-term data on the saliva testing, but what is the thinking about saliva versus the swab?
Well, that's a really important question, Amy, because anytime you talk about a test, you have to look at how accurate it is and what kind of results it gives. Theories are that it likely results in lower exposure to healthcare workers, which is why so much attention is going towards this type of saliva testing. And in terms of data, it may actually give more consistent results than the nasal swab. So again, what that's referring to is false positives or false negatives. A test is only as good as the data or results you can get from it. So a lot of enthusiasm or hope about this saliva test.
And yet, we talk about this a lot, there are still so many unknowns.
Right. And so one of the biggest is how or if this will be utilized, let's say in workplace or even school communities, how it can be manufactured and then processed in massive quantities, because that is a key that that involves supply chain issues. And then again, cost. You have to talk about cost. If something is available, like I'm hoping for, let's say on the drugstore shelf, it has to be inexpensive enough that people can go get it and use it in many cases repeatedly.
Right, because it's not one and done.
Probably not.
No. All right. Dr. Jen, thank you very much. Over the weekend, as we mentioned, a wave of protests swept across this country in response to the death of George Floyd. In Oakland, as in many cities, what started as peaceful protests turned violent with reports of vandalism and looting. Here to discuss this is Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf. And Mayor Schaaf, last night we know that shots were fired at the police administration building. And unlike other cities in the Bay Area, you have not imposed a curfew. Why?
We have not imposed a curfew at this time because we want to focus our law enforcement resources on people who are committing criminal acts, violence, vandalism, looting. And we did make 60 arrests last night. And we recognize that we are not taking that off the table. We are constantly assessing the conditions and the intelligence that we have. But if we do impose a curfew, it's with the knowledge that historically curfews have been used as tools of government oppression and racial bias. And so it's very important that we recognize that historical context should we choose to use what is a pretty indiscriminate tool. Again, last night we were able to be very effective at bringing people to justice, removing them from doing the harm to our community, but it is at an unacceptable level. We certainly are looking at every tool at our disposal, even though we recognize the historical context of this particular tool.
And, you know, obviously we are in really tough times, even before this, with this pandemic, business owners struggling. What would you like to say to those business owners in Oakland who are now also concerned about their property and their safety right now?
Yeah, we are in a lot of pain in this city. To wake up and see, you know, our beloved community trashed with hateful messages graffitied everywhere and incredible damage to not just, you know, big corporate stores, but little mom and pops, many businesses owned by people of color. And that is what has been so painful. You know, Oakland was one of the very first parts of this whole country to go into a shelter in place. We've been taking the coronavirus pandemic very seriously. And so these small business folks are just hanging on by a thread already. And they are so sympathetic You know, this is Oakland. We are the birthplace of social movements. We have been doing this hard work around racial social justice for a long time. And so to see these store owners that have put their entire lives into their livelihoods, it has been heartbreaking. But we are continuing to create safe space for those who want to express their justifiable rage and grief at the national travesty of racism. But we are also trying to protect our community. And it has been very disconcerting just to see the national level of civil unrest.
No, certainly, certainly. And we've heard actually from the Atlanta mayor earlier today about this next question. How concerned are you about the potential spread of the coronavirus in your city now as a result of all of these people gathering in close contact during these protests?
I am terrified. Because let's be clear, this virus spreads so easily. And I am very concerned that 2 weeks from now, we will see a tremendous spike. On Friday night, we had nearly 8,000 protesters all in a single tight group. That is not safe. I will commend other kind of activists organized a car caravan to demonstrate yesterday, 2,000 cars. Now, that was socially distant and also expressing appropriately during the daytime, raising up the issue that is really in people's hearts right now. But people cannot afford to get sick. And many of the impacts last night were in the very neighborhoods that have been disproportionately impacted by the coronavirus. And that has been just what has really been painful as a mayor that is so committed to the safety and well-being of my community.
Now, Mayor Schaaf, over the weekend, two federal officers stationed outside a federal building there in downtown Oakland were shot. Unfortunately, one of those officers was killed. And a senior official from Homeland Security tells ABC News that shooting is related to the protests over Floyd's death. Authorities are calling it an act of domestic terrorism. What can you tell us about this investigation right now?
Yeah, our hearts go out to the friends and families of Patrick Underwood. He is the federal agent who was killed on Friday night. And this level of hatred and animus is just killing our country. It is ripping us apart. All this harm is not advancing the message. My understanding is that whether or not it is related, is still under investigation. It is being seen as an act of domestic terrorism. And we certainly hope that the FBI and federal investigators bring Mr. Underwood's killer to justice.
Well, we certainly want to thank you, Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf, for taking the time to speak with us today during these times.
Thank you.
Up next, right here when we come back, Dr. Jen Ashton joining us with your coronavirus questions, plus the beloved tradition looking a lot different this year for many families, the virtual summer camp that may offer a getaway without ever leaving home. Welcome back to What You Need to Know. We have Dr. Jen Ashton here in the house. And Dr. Jen, there's a new study out that is looking at the connection between diabetics and complications with COVID-19.
Yeah, this was really interesting. It was a study done in France, and they were looking at patients with diabetes, both types, type 1 and type 2, because usually when we hear the word diabetes, without even saying it, we're really kind of dealing with the people with type 2 diabetes. But this study in France found that 1 in 10 patients with diabetes died in the first 7 days after hospitalization for COVID-19. 1 in 5 patients with diabetes needed ventilatory support in terms of breathing. They need to be put on a ventilator. In terms of this group, they found higher rates of death against with men with diabetes, with obese men with diabetes, and with diabetes alone. And they teased it out. 89% had type 2 diabetes, 3% had type 1 diabetes. And again, the thinking is that just having diabetes can alter our immune response, our basic inflammation level, which again
may then interact with COVID-19. And so learning more about this population, really, really important, because we've known really from the beginning that they're at much higher risk.
And so you always say it's important to know how you can use results. So what can we do about
exactly
these findings?
And so I think one of the hopes or directions in the future is that if you really understand how high risk this group is, then could they be screened differently? Could they get aggressive treatment that differs from patients who don't have diabetes? That's the key in medicine. Once you make that observation, tailoring it to actually improve clinical outcomes.
Right. From the onset, when they walk in, if they know they're diabetic, maybe there could be a more aggressive form of
Hopefully,
treatment from
we'll
the
see.
Beginning.
Exactly. That's the hope.
Next question. Now that things are opening up, should we be concerned about using currency rather than credit cards?
So many people wondering the same thing, Amy. And I think, first of all, it depends on how you felt before about using currency. Remember that the virus has not disappeared. It's still there. So we have to learn how to live with it. Good news is that just recently we heard the CDC say they believe that contact spread, or fomite transmission, to geek out with the technical term, is not a major route of spread of coronavirus. So again, hand washing is the most important thing, and we have to balance. We can't live our life in a sterile environment.
Yeah, that's right. This next question I'm going to be listening to, because I haven't seen my mother in 5 months. So this viewer asks, I haven't seen my mother in 4 months because she lives 1,200 miles away. What is the best way for me to visit? Is it safe to fly, or is driving the best method?
Well, interestingly, you know, what we know about the transmission of various respiratory pathogens in air travel is not as bad as people think. It's actually a lot safer than you think, depending on various conditions, obviously spacing, hand hygiene, wearing masks. That air is circulated every 4 minutes through HEPA filters on major airlines. So that's good news. Driving, of course, can be safe as well. But again, when you stop, if you need to get gas, use a bathroom, eat, stay overnight in a motel or hotel, you could get exposure then. So it's about balancing that and making an individual decision about what's best for you.
All right. Next question. Could a microwave or oven kill COVID-19 on surfaces like paper, plastic, or food?
Probably. But again, to go back to the CDC recent finding, they really don't think that surfaced contact or transmission is a major concern here for this spread. So microwave or intense heat kills almost everything. But where are you going to draw the line then, right? You can't obviously microwave or heat everything. So I think it's a balance. And again, the respiratory transmission, much, much more of a risk.
Yeah, that's important to remember when you're weighing what to do,
right?
All right, next question. Do you think we will see requirements for international travel that may include showing testing and results for both people entering and leaving the U.S.?
Well, very interesting question, because, again, you and I have spoken about this so much. If you test someone, it doesn't catch everyone who's infected. That's just a basic premise of infectious disease, because there is a latency period from when someone is exposed to when the disease starts to manifest, either with symptoms or, in this case, 40% possibly don't have any symptoms. So if you screen based on symptoms, you're going to miss people. Any test can have false negatives. So whether we're going to see that coming soon to a theater near us, unclear at this point. I'm sure people are looking at it country by country. But again, that's not the only infectious disease that we have to worry about. It's just added to the list. And right now it's at the top of the list.
That's true. All right, Dr. Jen, always giving us that good perspective. We appreciate it. And you can submit questions to Dr. Jen on her Instagram at Dr. J. Ashton. This summer is going to look a lot different this year due to the coronavirus. Many camps are closed or are operating on limited capacity, which means parents will have to switch from homeschool teacher to camp counselor. Well, here to help and tell us all about her virtual summer camp called Happy Camper Live is Allison Miller. Allison, thanks so much for being with us, and tell us how you created Happy Camper Live.
So I'm actually a real life summer camp director. I've been a camp director for 22 years. And about 2.5 years ago, my husband and daughter volunteered at Global Camps Africa, and they spent 2 weeks working with kids from the poorest townships of Soweto. And when they came back, their lives were changed, and they kept talking about their experience and the impact it had on the kids that they work with. And day after day, we'd be in these conversations, and I said to my husband, I want to bring summer camp to every kid in the world. No matter where they are geographically, no matter what their socioeconomic background is, I want to bring them the magic of summer camp. And so this was created 2.5 years ago, when we spent 2 summers filming and engaging real camp counselors in producing these hundreds of camp activities that are part of our website today.
All right. And so, yes, I can understand how that might happen in person, but how do you bring that experience to these kids virtually?
Well, what's great is we have so many things that we can bring kids into our world. We have live activities every day where we have these real camp counselors that are engaging with the kids, inspiring them in terms of what their passions are. And then we have hundreds of other activities that we have produced that have sports and music and art and fitness and dancing and all of the things that we do at summer camp, bringing them right to their homes. We also created this 360-degree virtual experience where they actually go into the camp and they can try those activities and experience them in the actual facilities in a campground. So while we can't bring them all to camp, we are bringing camp to them.
Pretty cool. And I'm sure parents who are listening to this are thinking this sounds pretty nice. But the next question will be, does it cost money to participate?
So we have free content every single day for kids, and we make that accessible. That's part of my mission. We have live content as well as recorded content that they can experience, as well as a subscription model, which is $4.99 for a month or $11.99 for 3 months. So we tried to price it very reasonably, but there's plenty of things for the kids to do that's free. And also we have a great blog that gives parents tons and tons of ideas of what they can also do too.
Well, Allison Miller, thank you for all that you're doing. And I'm sure parents everywhere are applauding your efforts as well. Thank you so much and have a wonderful summer.
Thank you. You too.
Now, the rising problem of dropping vaccination rates, a casualty of the coronavirus pandemic. ABC's Diane Macedo with the warning from doctors and some creative possible solutions.
As the world anxiously awaits a vaccine for COVID-19, experts warn children nationwide are falling behind on other vaccines, leaving them vulnerable to dangerous, preventable diseases. A recent survey by ABC News shows every one of the 20 states that responded reported a rapid decrease in the number of children receiving routine vaccinations. This after the CDC reported the number of vaccine doses ordered from mid-March to mid-April was down from last year by 2.5 million. Doctors warn the drop could lead to so-called mini epidemics.
Measles, there's also pertussis. We're really worried we're going to see untold cases of measles, and measles is way more infectious than COVID is.
They're now trying to assure patients that the doctor's office is a safe place to be. As I recently took my son for his own vaccinations, the waiting room was completely empty, and his doctor assured me precautions are in place.
We see sick visits in the afternoon, then we clean everything up, decontaminate overnight, and start everything all over again. We wear protective gowns to help protect you and me.
Some are also finding creative ways to make these visits as easy as possible. Here in New York, my pediatrician has teamed up with adult doctors to offer family checkups.
The children can get seen by the pediatrician, and then the adults who may have been neglecting their own health care can come to get seen as well, all at the same time.
For me, it meant I could just walk down the hall and get my own checkup, long overdue.
I would not have gotten my checkup otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely.
The trip I was fearing for me and my son ended up bringing me much peace of mind for his health and my own.
And our thanks to Diane for that. A challenge parents and caregivers are facing right now is understanding the importance of getting your children vaccinated, even and maybe even especially during a pandemic. So to shed a little more light and answer a few questions on the topic of vaccines, please welcome Dr. Harvey Karp, renowned pediatrician, sleep expert, inventor of the Snoo, and New York Times bestselling author. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Karp. So if you can start by telling us the importance of getting your kids vaccinated before, during, and after a pandemic.
I know it's a crazy, crazy time. And of course, everybody's been sheltering at home. And so that's caused a real drop in visits to the doctor and immunizations. But, you know, parents would line up around the block if there were a vaccine against COVID. And we have great vaccines against so many illnesses that are even much more serious for young children than COVID is. Measles, meningitis, things like that, whooping cough, which can be quite serious and land children in the hospital or even worse. So it's understandable why there's been a reduction in the number of vaccinations. Some states like Massachusetts and Minnesota show a 60 or 70% drop. But now that we're kind of inching back into our lives, we also have to get back into getting our children protected. And there are so many ways that doctors are making that easy and safe for families.
That's right. And I know you say there are two reasons we should not put off those vaccines. What are they?
Well, of course, one is to protect your child, right? I mean, you want your child to be protected against getting some serious illness. The other is to protect all the other children in your community, because these are very contagious diseases. Measles, a huge outbreak in Washington State earlier in the year. Measles is like 1,000 times more contagious than COVID is. And so just as all of the other children who have gotten vaccinated and all of the parents who have brought their kids to the doctors to get vaccinated over the last 10 years are protecting your child right now, so there's less illness around, the babies who are born a month and two and a year from now are depending on all of us to get our vaccines to keep the rates of illnesses low so they're not at risk.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. And obviously, we know it's important to keep our babies and our children safe. But sometimes as parents, we forget that we're important, too. So explain what parents can do to stay safe and healthy while keeping their family safe.
Well, you know, as Jen said earlier, it's all about good hygiene right now. You know, wash your hands or use hand sanitizer and wear a mask when you're out in public. And try to get your sleep, which is hard to do as a parent. But, you know, you want to do the best you can to avoid COVID right now. That's the big scary thing. And the last thing a parent wants is to get sick with that. Babies don't do so badly with it, but adults can be seriously ill. So probably the number one thing for parents to do right now is to do all those good hygiene recommendations that all doctors are talking about.
Yes, because if we're not healthy, we can't take care of the people we love. Dr. Harvey Karp, thank you so much for that very important advice. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Amy. Be safe.
Thank you. Same to you. The Camden Coalition is a nonprofit organization based in Camden, New Jersey, that works to improve care for individuals who have complex health and social needs. Well, now the organization has helped turn a local New Jersey hotel into a shelter for individuals recovering from COVID-19 who are either homeless or do not have a safe place to quarantine. Here to discuss the incredible work the Camden Coalition has been doing is Michelle Adinek, a registered nurse and clinical manager at the organization. Michelle, thank you so much for being with us. And tell us first just how the Camden Coalition happened in the first place.
Thanks for having me. The Camden Coalition for years has worked to serve vulnerable individuals in the Camden community and around the Camden community to improve their health and well-being. And we've always really lived by the philosophy that it takes a village to support the community's needs. And so we've always had strong partnerships. And when the pandemic hit, we worked with existing partnerships with the Volunteers of America, who run the local shelters, and the county, and we all shared the understanding that there was going to be people within our community who would test positive for COVID and would need a safe place to go to quarantine.
Yeah, that's a beautiful story how it happened organically. So can you walk me through your daily routine, what the care process is like for these people?
Yeah, so most of the people who arrive are come as referrals from either the hospital or community organizations. And then when they arrive, they stay at the hotel, and our nurses call them on the phone mostly to make sure that their symptoms, monitoring their symptoms and making sure they have their needs met. And then we do a lot of coordination with their primary care doctors, medication coordination, things like that. And in some instances, if we need to do more thorough assessment, then we will go into the hotel to do that.
That's incredible. I know all the while making sure that workers like yourself are staying safe as well as the patients. What happens once an individual is ready to leave the hotel?
So once somebody is ready to leave, we get really excited and we say, hey, you kicked COVID. And we make sure that they have a safe place to transition to for housing. So the Volunteers of America has been doing a great job of helping individuals get into transition to a shelter or another option to where they can go and continue to heal.
That is beautiful in every way. Thank you so much for all that you do, Michelle Adinek, for the work from you and the Camden Coalition. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we turn now to our Dr. Jen Ashton for final thoughts on this Monday.
So, Amy, I want to give people a prescription to deal with the intense emotional and psychological stress, as well as the physical stress that everyone is dealing with right now. So that's going to be the theme of the week. And I'm going to kick it off with one of the most important things we can all do for our head-to-toe health, which is sleep. We've talked about before how sleep has been very commonly disrupted during the pandemic for a slew of reasons. Sleep has a major PR problem in this country. We look at it like it's a luxury. It is a medical necessity. And if people are listening that want to do something to improve their immune system, start with sleep. Wow. An adult, 7 to 9 hours a night, there are powerful associated effects and causative effects that being sleep deprived can have on your immune system. So make today the priority to set a regular sleep schedule, make your bedroom cold, dark, and quiet. I promise you that getting 7 to 9 hours of sleep will improve how you think, how you feel, and potentially really improve your immune system as well.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jen. And that's our program for today. I'm Amy Robach. Thanks for listening.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table.
What is happening here?
It's just beautiful chaos.
Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view.
To be honest, I was thinking about asking him for a foot massage, and then I just froze.
This is the best gig on TV.
And you know, anything can happen.
That is what we do here.
I'm not going to lie, the chair's a little small for my behind.
The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.